Thursday evening, Subway Station. Pushers, pushers, races, racers, racing. Wow, I'm botching this. That lyric goes on to say the power's out across the nation. That's St. Vincent. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jay's Talk Plus. The power is out, apparently, with me as well. Sorry for the bad start. Power was out at the Blue Jays game last night. It made for one of the more interesting Toronto Blue Jays broadcasts that we've had, both on the radio and the television side. For anyone who missed it, the Jays won 9-1. So all's well that ends well. The third time in four games, the Jays score 9 runs, 27 over their last four now, which even with the shutout mixed in there is their best four-game stretch of offense we've seen this year. And yeah, it's came against the two pretty shaky White Sox pitchers. Eric Fedde, who'd had a nice start to this point in the season, but isn't quite that guy. Nick Nastrini, who was right up from struggling at AAA, and then yesterday with Jack Flaherty, who was actually really good, but the Jays managed to get to him in the seventh and then really get to the Tigers bullpen to add on some insurance. So if you missed it, 9-1 victory. The first inning, so shortly before the game started, the power went out in the truck complex at Comerica Park. So that means there is power to parts of the stadium, but none of the broadcast trucks, none of the TV trucks, nothing like that had power. This is not, and to be clear, this wasn't like a Rogers thing. The Tigers broadcast was down. You'll be shocked to learn that everyone doesn't carry their electricity with them. You assume the home team's going to be able to provide electricity to the broadcast. So, we had no broadcast for the first inning. The second inning, we had the steady shot from center field, and Jamie Campbell and Caleb Joseph were trying to do the call over it from the Blue Jay Central studio. We got a couple innings of Dan Schulman and Joe Siddle calling off that one screen while at the game on their cell phones. And then finally, right before the Blue Jays offense exploded, we got a proper broadcast back. So again, all's well that ends well. We got to see the big offensive innings with the full broadcast. It's one we'll probably remember at the end of the season as, remember that game where Dan Schulman was calling it from his cell phone and it wasn't synced up with the video, and poor Isaiah Kiner-Falefa hits a home run and a triple that, you know, he probably can't go back and watch the video of. It was a fun one. And the Jays won 9-1. They've won four of their last five now. So, maybe you're a little more frustrated with how that played out if they don't win that one. But they did in resounding fashion. Good Kevin Gausman start. A lot of offense. Ben Nicholson-Smith of Sportsnet.ca was down there for it. He joins us now. Ben, good morning. How we doing, buddy?
Doing great, Blake. The internet, knock on wood, is holding up for us this morning. I was able to watch the baseball game last night, and like you said, it was a very different kind of atmosphere, even for the people who are at Comerica Park.
It's I do want to touch on that, but I want to do a little bit of like inside baseball media for a second. Like, the job of a beat reporter is still very important. You're telling the stories. You're the one in there asking John Schneider the questions, getting insight from Kevin Gausman on his start, etc. However, have you ever felt more valuable as a beat reporter than in a game where potentially nobody has gotten to see this?
Oh, it's kind of like in spring training when, you know, you're watching like maybe a game in the backfield, someone's rehabbing, and then you're like, whatever you say just goes. Like, if you say that pitcher was dealing and throwing 95, like, no one can fact check you. It's probably what it was like to write about baseball in the 90s or something before Baseball Savant was everywhere, because your authority is just unquestioned. But no, I mean, it's a good thing, obviously, to have more information and to have fans able to tune in and find that themselves. And last night, we finally got there in the end.
Okay, so you mentioned that it was a different experience even for the people at the park. So I could tell that at a certain point, like, the game day stuff went out. We had pitch locations, but we didn't have pitch velocity, exit velocity. Couldn't even, I mean, you could obviously always eyeball what a pitch is. If Kevin Gausman throws something that whips back into a right-hander, it's okay, he's throwing that two-seamer. If one bot falls out of the bottom of the zone, okay, that's the splitter. But we didn't have the velocity readings, things like that. What else was different at the actual park?
Well, okay, so it's not just us who didn't have that information, right? It's the players. So
right.
because the players didn't have that information, they don't have the same instant feedback response loop that they're accustomed to. This was really different for the players. And talking to the Blue Jays after the game, they were like, yeah, this was a totally different experience. And for Kevin Gausman, he said he thinks he was pitching with reduced velocity. And, you know, even now, we have a little bit of the data. I don't know, maybe Blake, you found the full effort somewhere. You're shaking
nope.
Your head. No. But So I never found the data. I didn't know what Kevin Gausman was throwing during the game. I kind of assumed he was dealing because he was getting swing and miss. He was getting strikeouts. But Gausman himself said he actually didn't think he had great stuff that day. And he said he was glad that the Tigers were not able to see the radar gun readings, because if they saw that he was throwing 91, 92, they might have taken some bigger hacks against him. So that was interesting. He thought that was a positive. Isaiah Kiner-Falefa told me that it was almost like being a kid, where like you have to rely on your eyes. You have to rely on the other hitters. You can't just look and dial up video of the guy's last splitter. You have to actually see it and trust your teammates in a way that they don't normally have to.
And that, it's fascinating. You know, obviously there will be bad actors who jump to that and try and tie one thing to another. Oh, the offense was good when they didn't have the iPads or whatever. Yeah. Worth noting that 6 of the 9 runs happened once the technology came back at the end of the game, by the way. I was told they got access to all that stuff back in around the 7th or 8th inning. They tacked on, obviously, a bunch of extra runs in the 8th or 9th. It is still fun to think about how that changes your process, right? And kind of even something as simple as like it takes you out of the routine of you are only looking at things one way every single time up very, very consistently. So hearing IKF talk about that, Dalton Varsho talk about that, Kevin Gausman, I kind of think the edge would go to the pitchers with the, even though, and this is a weird thing to think of, because like so much of the technology and the data that we've gotten over the last decade or so has favored the pitchers. Now to say, well, if you take that away, it also favors the pitchers, but the pitchers are coming from such a first mover advantage and hitters have to react to the pitchers that I really do think the edge in a blackout game would go toward the pitchers, where the hitters have a little less sense of what they're seeing or what the last guy saw.
Yes, in game, the advantage would go to the pitchers. If you said for a full off season, pitchers can't use tech.
Oh yeah,
it would obviously.
Oh yeah,
and we'd have the hitters get a bit of an advantage. But yeah, it was a different game, and of course, you know, no one is going to put the genie back in the bottle at this point. Like, if you can have an iPad in your dugout, you should. Like, it's a small advantage. Now, of course, maybe it's just a useful reminder. You don't want to get too tech dependent. And that, honestly, it goes for all of us, right? Like, how many of us have a second screen up? I know, like, I'm used to being able to see exactly what Kevin Gausman's throwing. Maybe last night's the night where, as a writer, I have to use my eyes a little bit more. And I can't assume that I can just double check on game day if I miss a play. Like, I actually have to pay attention, which, you know, that's a good thing. I think it's a good thing for everyone involved to have your eyes on the field. Because look, they've played thousands of games in Detroit, and most of them happen without the internet, right? Like, you can play baseball without the internet. And I love both baseball and the internet, but, you know, you don't always have to have them working in lockstep.
Yeah, there's even little stuff like, you know, Kiermaier throws the runner out at home, and I just, like, on instinct, I'm like, I'm going to look up what the miles per hour on that throw was. I'm just curious, like, did he hit 100 on that one? Because it looked like a terrific throw. But we don't know anymore. We don't have it for that one. I thought too, you know, it's worth saying, I joked around a little bit about, you know, Dan and Joe being on their cell phones and stuff like that. They deserve a world of credit. They did a tremendous job calling that game without the benefit of the usual setup, trying to sync what they were talking about up with our video and things like that. And, you know, Dan and Joe are such pros that they can handle that. But even things like, you know, the truck being able to feed you a stat and things like, hey, Isaiah Kiner-Falefa has a home run and a triple. Has he hit for the cycle? When was the last time a Blue Jay hit for the cycle? Those are the kind of things that you can't look up on the fly. And we can obviously tell baseball stories without that access, but it does change things. The other thing I thought of, Ben, and I don't know if you talked to the Blue Jays about this or if like Lance Barrett, I doubt he did like a pool where I don't know how it works. Can you guys request umpires, by the way? In basketball, we can request to have a pool reporter talk to the head referee if there's like controversy. There was no controversy yesterday, but like what would have happened if there was controversy on, like, Lance Barrett had a really bad game behind the plate, by the way, based on what we could see, but there'd be no way to have replayed a close call or anything like that.
Well, exactly. So yeah, to answer your first question, it would be similar to basketball, where essentially the reporting crew can request to speak with an umpire, and then they can clarify things at that point. But yeah, there was no replay review. So for the first 6 innings, if there had been a close play, John Schneider could not have challenged. You know, you're just totally stuck with whatever call they make on the field. Thankfully, there were no controversial ones. I mean, it was basically a pretty clean game from that standpoint, but what a weird dynamic.
Yeah, it's a bizarre one. Hopefully we don't run into it again. Okay, so Kevin Gausman, we can't look at something today. And there was a good piece by Mikey Ahedo up at Baseball Prospectus yesterday before Gausman start looking into some of his struggles so far this year. And you know, the fastball and splitter velocity are both down 1 mile per hour. We don't know what the readings were yesterday. We only got them for five pitches. So who knows? That's not enough to say. But it certainly looked from the TV broadcast and from that center field camera that it was nasty and the Tigers couldn't hang on to it. What do you make of the fact that Gausman himself thought his stuff wasn't so sharp in a game where he did get, I think, 18 swing and misses? Like he got the results that Kevin Gausman has been searching for in that game.
Well, I would say a couple things there. One, I would trust Kevin Gausman's assessment of his own stuff because he knows it really well. Two, for him to get those results and strike out 10, work his way through six innings without his best stuff speaks to him as a veteran major league pitcher who knows what he's trying to do and who can read swings on the fly. And three, I would say this really tells us something about the Tigers. Like, they are not a good offensive team. And, you know, we cover the Blue Jays, right, Blake? Like, we know a thing or two about watching a team that can pitch and not hit. And wow, do the Tigers ever have echoes of that, right? Especially, you know, obviously Flaherty, really, really good. Tarek Skubal, unbelievable pitcher, might win the Cy Young in the American League this year, depending on how things go. And Reese Olson, who will probably pitch later this weekend, he's also been great for the Tigers. So they can really pitch, but man, they cannot hit. Like, this is a great matchup for Alek Manoah tonight. It's a great chance for him to kind of continue building that momentum. This is not a good offensive baseball team.
Reese Olson, by the way, who we could circle back on in a bit, but he was slated to throw a bullpen yesterday to make sure he's good to go on the weekend. He got hit by a comebacker in his last start. The Tigers also working through whether or not Kenta Maeda will be available in this series and whether that would be Saturday or Sunday. That would determine, you know, how Olson, Casey Mize, and Kenta Maeda shape up. We'll get Matt Manning tonight, who has not had a particularly good season, a former first-round pick, kind of getting his fourth crack at it here and has taken a step backward. He'll be opposed by Alek Manoah. You mentioned it, Ben. This is not a bad spot for Alek Manoah. Now, we looked at when he first came back up, that was a tough landing spot, his first game back. Not the toughest of landing spots, but he had a tough go. He had a bad first start. And then we're looking at, okay, well, maybe you change the timing of who he's facing and when he pitches so that it's a little bit of an easier ramp up. But then he handles a Twins team that is lefty heavy and can really hit the long ball. He handles a Tampa Bay Rays team that isn't the best Rays offense we've ever seen, but we know they're a very smart organization. If Alek Manoah was, you know, not back, if one of his pitches was off, if he was tipping anything, that's a team that would be all over that. And he got through both of those clean. Three unearned runs against the Twins, otherwise 14 pretty good innings. This is a Tigers team that is 28th in home runs against right-handed pitching and bottom 10 in weighted runs created plus against right-handed pitching. So when we control for ballpark factors and things like that, what are you looking for from Alek Manoah tonight as, like, you know, don't want to do the like chest out, he's back, but you know, this could potentially be a third really good start in a row for him. And then he'd face the White Sox next, who are the worst offense in baseball. There's a good opportunity here for Manoah to get some really positive momentum.
Yeah, it's a great chance for him. I remember last summer when the Jays were here, it was Manoah's first comeback from being optioned the first time, and he did great here. And so he's got a chance to build on that again. Of course, the last time the Blue Jays faced Matt Manning, he no-hit them, if I'm not mistaken. So, you know, maybe better things ahead for the offense this time. We'll see. Yeah, as for Alek Manoah, it is a great chance these next couple starts to continue building. And very simply, for him to do that, I think what the Jays are going to be looking for, what I will be looking for, is can he continue just filling up the strike zone? And we know the stuff is there. The stuff is toward, you know, where it was for the bulk of 2022. His stuff right now is probably better than it was at the end of 2022. And it's definitely better than where it was all of last year. So the stuff is there. Can he fill the strike zone with it consistently? We've seen him do that two outings in a row. And when he does, he gets ahead, the stuff plays. If he can do that against the Tigers tonight, the stuff will play. He will have good results. So it's a question of being ahead of these hitters, being aggressive. And I'm very intrigued to see if he can do that.
Yeah, I think, you know, against righties, against either-handed batter, the most important thing is going to be, like you're saying, staying in the zone. He threw that two-seam fastball in the zone 61% of the time last time out, and the Rays didn't make a single piece of good contact against it. That, to me, says worlds about his ability to execute inside the zone but not over the meatball part of the plate, and just to be, you know, consistent and aggressive with it. This is a Tigers team that, you know, maybe the emphasis is back on that changeup tonight, because they do have four lefties and a switch hitter. All of those players, except for Zach McKinstry, play regularly. Riley Green's a lefty, Kerry Carpenter, Cole Keith, and then Wincell Perez. So all of those guys could be in the lineup hitting from the left side. What have you liked about the way he's used the changeup, or just, you know, the fact that he's leaning on it a pretty big amount? Because that was something that last year, you know, we were kind of waiting for it, I think, especially when the slider wasn't all that effective, and he just never really leaned on it that much.
Right. And I think because he was just having so much trouble commanding his pitches, you know, going to that third pitch, having confidence to use it, just wasn't there. The results weren't there. And then fast forward to this year and what he was able to do against the Rays, it was such an even pitch mix where you see a lot of sliders, but you also see a lot of changeups. And then within the fastball distribution, you got four seamers and two seamers. So that makes him unpredictable. Twins, a good lineup. The Tigers, definitely less so. So he has a chance to continue just keeping these hitters off balance. But for him, it all starts from the delivery being in balance and really dynamic down the mound toward home plate, not flying open, not getting out of sync. So if he can be in that consistent delivery toward home plate, he will be able to execute those pitches in the strike zone and then keep getting ahead of hitters.
Okay, so on the let's see the other side of this now. Will he have some run support? So I kind of fast forwarded through the fact that the Jays did score 9 runs last night. Like, tech and internet and power issues aside, they put up a 9 spot. It's the third time in 4 games they've done it. And again, I mentioned off the top, it's not like they're doing this against the absolute best pitchers in the world, but Eric Fetty had been having a pretty nice season to date, and they got to a Tigers bullpen yesterday that's been pretty good. They, you know, Flaherty maybe shouldn't have still been in there in the seventh, and that let them get things rolling a little bit. But Alex Fiedo's been really, really good this year. And then they added a couple of insurance ones there against Englert in the ninth. Again, acknowledging the quality of competition asterisk here to some degree, what are you making of the fact that the Jays have strung together a few games with real offense here?
Well, it's what you have to do when you're facing these teams that are not as good, and you're not going to have these chances forever, right? Like, at a certain point, you are going to have to go back to facing the Baltimore Orioles and the New York Yankees and the teams that are, like, so clearly better than the Blue Jays. But right now, say what you will about the Jays, the White Sox, the Tigers, these are still worse teams than Toronto. So they need to take advantage of it. If they're going to do anything in the standings and push back to 500 and above, I mean, they have a chance to do that right here in the course of the next week, where you still have 6 more games against Chicago and Detroit. That is a dream setup. You have to take advantage of that and go, you know, at least 4-2 in the course of these next 6, try to keep building, because you just don't get that many chances. I don't think that, you know, the Blue Jays offense is solved. I'm not going to say that on a day that Vlad Jr.'s slugging percentage just finally barely ticked above 400. And this is a guy who's been red hot for a month, and he's been incredible. And, like, you know, give him credit. It's not easy to go deep to center field at Comerica Park, but, you know, we're not exactly talking about, you know, like someone who's on pace to hit 30 home runs. He's on pace to hit, you know, 17 at this point.
Yeah, it's, look, the Vlad thing is interesting, because that is about the most difficult a home run you can hit in Major League Baseball, dead center to Comerica. I know they brought some of the dimensions in the other year because it had just played too pitcher friendly in the modern environment, but 423 to dead center is a big, big home run. He really does, like, you look at his home run sprays too, he really does only hit him to the toughest part of the ballparks. If we're looking at the last 22 games here, so we're talking about the better part of a month, hitting 372 with a 943 OPS. That's not, you know, that's really good. And even if that OPS is OBP inflated, if we look at his whole season now, he's up to a 779. If we control for league average, because the league offensive environment is down now, this is actually closer to 2022 than 2023 for Vlad. So he's having, you know, relative to the rest of the league, a bit of a better season this year. That feels weird considering that was only his fifth home run yesterday. You know, I don't think the prescription is ever going to be for Vlad to look for more power. I think he's just going to have to find it while he's, you know, hitting like he's hitting lately. What would need to happen for the Jays to be, you know, okay with an OBP-driven final line like this from Vlad? Like, is this on Vlad to find his way to more home runs? Would you be okay with this if other guys were hitting a little bit more? I don't want to look a gift horse in the mouth when he's, you know, again, a 943 OPS over the last month or so. But it does feel a little incongruent with the fact that they still really need power.
And I think because Vladdy's someone who has the power, if he's getting on base a ton and, you know, he's not hitting 30 homers, but he's hitting 20 homers, pitchers are still going to be scared of him. That's going to be a sustainable on base percentage. And you still know that if they make a mistake over the middle of the plate, he can make them pay. So I don't think that you're too worried about Vladdy if you're the Jays. I think that based on everything that I've heard from people around the team, you know, they love what they're seeing with him recently, of course. Like, why wouldn't you? Last night and for the last month. So he's really not the concern on this team. And I think that, you know, if you are looking at this lineup, it's much more so George Springer, who's, you know, hitting the ball on the ground too much, not getting that pull power in the air. It's Justin Turner, who has really slumped in the last month. And what do you do there? Daniel Vogelbach made some really hard contact last night, and he's had a better week, but, you know, he's had one good game all season. Kevin Kiermaier has really done very little. So I think to me, the concern is more with those veteran bats. Do you get them back on track? Do they have anything left? If not, how long of a leash do you give them? If not, who's coming up to replace them and in what capacity? So to me, it's more Springer, Kiermaier, Turner. What kind of production can you get from those older players? And Vladdy, he's going to be fine at this point.
Yeah, you mentioned those guys kind of who are sharing the DH role. Vogelbach and Turner both did have hits yesterday. The Jays did a fun thing that I always enjoy, which is Vogelbach gets a hit, pinch run for him. Biggio comes back up, pinch hit for him. It's Justin Turner. He gets on base, pinch run for him. Four guys shared the DH spot yesterday. It's always a fun bit of managing it and something you can only do kind of when you have good defenders in the field at other positions as well. Turner, you know, the team seems to think he's showing some signs of life the last little bit here. So maybe that's something, and maybe it's just because I have his best friend Tyler Toffoli on the show later. I'm trying to be Justin Turner optimistic here. The other side of this is, you know, Bo's hitting better as well. And you're right. Some of those other guys have to be able to contribute from the power department, especially the guys you're paying to kind of platoon that DH spot. Bo Bichette had another three-hit game yesterday. He was the guy who got to re-debut the home run jacket the night before. He's got an OPS over 1,000 over his last 12 games, and he's really trimmed the strikeouts in that stretch to more extra base hits than strikeouts over that 12-game stretch. What are you seeing on the Bo side of things?
Yeah, better contact for sure. And it's going to take a little bit more time to really fully have confidence that he's back to where he should be, just because of the nature of his slow start and how long it went for. I mean, what an unusual start to the season for Bo Bichette. But yeah, you can see it right there going opposite field. That's vintage Bo Bichette. You've got to love to see that if you're the Blue Jays. I am not ultimately going to be that concerned about him, again, relative to those older players, and Alejandro Kirk, I'll throw in there too, because even though Alejandro Kirk is a younger player, I do think there's reason to be a little concerned, just because he's also someone who isn't accessing that pull power in the air, and Alejandro Kirk on the ground is just not a good combination. So that's still a lot of hitters in this team where there's some real question marks. I don't think it's a very good offensive team. You know, I'd have to really be persuaded otherwise, but if they can be a really good pitching team and an okay offensive team, then maybe that's enough, right? Like, we're not talking about the Blue Jays as a division winner. We're not talking about them as a powerhouse. We're talking about, okay, maybe they can get into sneaking into a wild card. And I, you know, there's a pathway to that still.
We're trying to get them back to 500 here over this 13-game stretch, right? Like, that's like, I hope nobody is listening and being like, oh, they think the Jays are fake. No, we're trying to get them back to 500. And then you build up from there. It's not fixed. You're just trying to move it in the right direction there. You mentioned the pull side power. I pulled some numbers for our colleague David Singh the other day when he was writing that great piece on Springer trying to pull the ball in the air more. And I was looking at the players in the league with enough batted ball events who of the balls they do hit, pull it in the air less frequently. And the Jays had five players in the bottom 35 in the whole league. Like, this side of like 300 players, an average team would have, you know, a couple guys in there, not five guys in the bottom 35. I think it was IKF, Kirk, Kiermaier, Bichette, and Springer. And, like, you can live with a couple of those guys because, you know, guys who are contact hitters are going to use the whole field. They're not as pull heavy. But you probably don't want five guys, four of them who are like everyday regulars, to have that same kind of profile there. So some work to be done still, even with the positive signs here.
So much work to be done. I mean, yeah, there's still three games below 500, and you know, that could be, they could be there at the end of the weekend, or this could take them, they might never get there. Who knows, right? There's real work to be done. Best case for the Jays is just continue building this momentum. They've won four of five. They have a chance tonight to win three in a row for only the second time this season. Do it. Like, they got to go out there and do it. They can't wait around forever to finally just climb their way back. It's got to happen. It's got to happen now, because if you still are under 500 in a month, then your season is kind of spoken for.
Were you at the Matt Manning combined no-hitter last year?
Sure was. I've seen the Jays get hit no-hit many a time, at least four times.
Four times. So, Ronel Blanco, were you at that one?
Dairon Blanco, just give that a change up and a bit of pine tar, and the Blue Jays just go, you know, weak in the knees. It's,
so, Blanco, the Tigers combined one, Verlander and Paxton? Are those the... Damn. Yeah. I haven't been at any of those. I haven't been at one. I've never seen a no-hitter still. I don't know if I want to be on the wrong side of one. Closest I got was Dustin McGowan when he was with the Jays back in the day, and I think took one into the ninth. So,
well, it would be cool to be at a Jays no-hitter. And, hey, Kevin Gausman for five innings last night.
Yeah.
I mean, he was dealing.
Yeah, although they would have pulled him. So, you know,
they would have had to.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe the iPads wouldn't have told them to, because they didn't have iPads. We can do a whole thing about that. So last time they faced Matt Manning, he went 6 2/3, no hit. Jason Foley and Alex Lang, who just got optioned to the minors, cleaned that one up. Before I let you go here, Ben, we expecting bullpen reinforcements at some point this weekend. Bowden Francis and Chad Green got into their third and second AAA game, respectively, earlier this week.
Yeah, those guys are ready if needed. I think that at this point, you know, with the Jays not having to rely too heavily on their bullpen yesterday, I would think that you schedule Green and Francis for an appearance Saturday, unless Manoah goes like 2 1/3 tonight.
Okay.
You know, if Manoah goes 2 1/3 tonight and they have to use their bullpen heavily, then I would think that you make moves Saturday to bring those reinforcements back to the majors.
Okay. Otherwise, you're looking at, they get into a game Saturday, maybe they rejoin you Monday for the White Sox series or something like that. Of the guys who could potentially be outbound, Nate Pearson seems like a logical one, just given the performance and usage at the back end. There's an interesting decision beyond that in terms of Zach Pop has pitched pretty well since he's come up, but, you know, Hennessy Cabrera, they like to have a second lefty in there, maybe particularly because Tim Mayza hasn't been that effective. You know, Eric Swanson still has a double-digit ERA and is technically available to be optioned. I don't think they're going to go down that route. Do you have a lean on who the odd man out might be?
Well, there's always a chance that there's an injury that we aren't really thinking about right now. Beyond that, it's got to be a meritocracy. In my opinion, Zach Pop is pitching really well. Yenesis Cabrera is not. Simple.
Yeah. And it's what is it, the strained rhomboid major or whatever that or the there's the other one, the thoracic spine inflammation, the two that are just like, he's got a sore back, but we get the hyper specific those are the ones that probably every pitcher in baseball could go on the IL with at any time, because, like, yeah, of course your back sore, you're throwing 100 miles an hour. I lied. I'm going to give you one more just because I know you've looked ahead already. Things can change. The Pirates have a couple off days. They could juggle the rotation. This is good for the Blue Jays record, bad for us. It kind of looks like we're going to miss Paul Skeens and Jared Jones.
Yeah, it's too bad. Someone told me that Paul Skeens for a while was slated to line up and pitch against the Blue Jays. I think that would have been so fun. I know, you know, Blue Jays fans are probably thinking, like, well, this is great. We missed those two amazing pitchers. Also missing Scooble. I don't know. As a fan of the game, it's so fun to watch the best pitchers do what they do, especially when they come up, right? It's like seeing Gerrit Cole as a rookie. You're seeing Steven Strasburg as a rookie. It would be really cool. You know, I'm sure the Jays hitters are thrilled not to have to face Paul Skeens. But yeah, that would have been a fun one. He was really good yesterday. I mean, how good was his second major league start that he can go out there and pitch a quality start against the San Francisco Giants, allow, I want to say, one run, zero runs in six innings, and everyone's like, it's kind of disappointing. That tells you how good his second start was.
Yeah, it's crazy. We'll talk about that one more next week, I'm sure, as we tee that series up. Ben Nicholson-Smith, I know the Tigers series is your series every year, so enjoy the weekend, buddy.
Thanks, Blake.
Ben Nicholson-Smith of Sportsnet.ca, always indispensable, a little more so yesterday with our access to that game being a little limited. Got a text in. By the way, you could text us to 590-590. We'll sprinkle in some of your texts later in the show. JK Pockets texted me thinking, maybe I'm thinking about the Morrow no-hit bid, not the McGowan one. That was a good one too, but McGowan ended up with a one-hitter against the Colorado Rockies back in 2007. That was the game I was thinking of. I don't remember exactly when he gave that hit up, but 2007 against the Colorado Rockies. Rare interleague play one. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk to Ben Clemens of Fangraphs. We'll whip around Major League Baseball a little bit. In the second hour, we've got Dan Schulman joining us. We'll talk to NHL player Tyler Toffoli, who's close friends with Justin Turner, and we'll answer more of your mailbag questions to 590-590. Text them in as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Hey, it's Ailish Forafar.
And I'm Justin Cuthbert.
Join us as we discuss the most important sports stories of the day and tee up the biggest games of the night.
It's The Fan Pregame, 6 p.m. weekdays on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Ben Clemens of Fangraphs is here to pick us up now. Ben, what's going on, man? Thank you for doing this. Good morning.
Good morning, Blake. It's good to talk to you. How's it going?
It's going well. I feel like I'm probably slightly bit more sane than you are right now because for a piece at Fangraphs the other week, you watched 250 pop-ups. And I know you did that for good reason, for study. Did you see last night an infield fly pop-up end a ball game on a runner's interference that I guess by letter of the law is accurate, but is an absolutely terrible way to end a game? Did you catch one like that in your watch of 250 pop-ups?
You know, I did not, but I watched that, and if I were Pedro Grifol, I would have gotten like more ejected. Yeah. I mean, he got ejected, you know, I mean, the game was over, so it didn't really matter, but that was outrageous. I hope that they do something to like make sure this won't happen again, because it was just so obviously wrong and just like, frankly, kind of sucks as a way to end the baseball game, because even the Orioles didn't think anything was wrong.
So yeah, for anyone who missed it, there's runners on first and second with one out and there's an infield fly. So infield fly rules called, and Gunnar Henderson just happens to like bump into the base runner very, very slightly on his way to catch this infield fly. And the umpire says, well, that's also runner interference. So game over. You're out at second base as well. Okay. So Ben, more seriously, you did watch this. You did watch all of these pop-ups, and the point of what you were writing in Five Things at Fangraphs last week was, hey, MLB defenders are really, really good. And even though pop-ups very rarely drop in, they drop in a lot more often in the minor leagues. But you also had one note in there that is tangentially Jays related. Maybe we thought it would be Jays related at one point. You said everyone other than Joey Votto hits the occasional pop-up. Joey Votto, I loved tracking this stat at his peak. He went 9 years with only 7 infield flies. The league-wide rate is like 10% of balls hit in play are infield flies. Like that, to only have 7 over a 9-year stretch, how high does that rank for you in terms of just like individual statistical oddities that you've come across?
It is one of the highest. Before I was a baseball writer, when I was just a baseball fan, I was not a Reds fan. I didn't know anything. Like, I didn't have any particular affinity for Votto. If anything, I didn't like him that much because I was a Cardinals fan and, you know, he was constantly having good games against the Cardinals. But I knew that he was so good at bat control that he never hit pop-ups. And it was just so outrageous. You'd watch him play and he was just like incapable of it. I could never wrap my head around how he did it. And he did it, like, you know, not 1 year. It wasn't like he had this 1 year where it was just amazing, no pop-ups. He just never hit them at all. It was just truly spectacular. And like, the reason that I brought that up is because, look, I don't really track a lot of kind of non non-important stats. At the end of the day, like, it says to you that he has great bat control, but it matters much more what he does. But he went like most of his major league career without hitting a pop-up to the first base side of the bag. It's just truly spectacular. And, you know, like you said, it's kind of sad that it is something we thought would be Jays related instead of likely to be Jays related at this point. But man, like, he has had a truly remarkable career. He's turned out to be one of my favorite baseball players. Just he's a delight in every way. But if he, you know, if this was it for him, if this minor league attempt is his last remembrance, we don't get to see him anymore in the majors, I'm still going to be thinking about how just incredible he was at never hitting pop-ups.
It's ridiculous. Again, 7 over a 9-year stretch. It's or 9 over a 7-year stretch. Either way, just a crazy number of a few infield flies. And again, everyone, like league-wide, there's like 10% of your balls in play are considered pop-ups like that, and he just never did it. It'll be the second most fascinating stat after, his Blue Jays career was one spring training plate appearance. He had an OPS of 5,000, and we never saw him again, apparently. Okay, Ben, something else you wrote at Fangraphs recently was titled, "No, You Can't Trade Your Newfound Reliever for a Shiny Prospect." And this comes up with a lot of selling teams. Hey, a relief pitcher's having a really good half season. Could you cash in on that and get something at the trade deadline? And your takeaway was kind of, well, not unless you're an established reliever. Like we saw the Jays add Jordan Hicks, Henesis Cabrera last year for basically nothing. Anthony Bass and Zach Pop the year before that. Or I shouldn't say Jordan Hicks for nothing. They gave up some good stuff for Hicks. But you can add relievers for not a lot. And Hicks was a case where there was a track record of him being a hard thrower and a bat misser at least. But for the most part, there's so little predictive ability between what a reliever does in the first half of the season and the second half, especially if they're not an established name. I bring this up as a part A because part B might be related to, well, you know, we've gotten asked a lot on this show, what could the Jays get for Jimmy Garcia if things go the wrong way? So we'll start with the part A of this, which is, you know, market-wise, teams aren't really buying when a guy has just one really strong chunk of a season.
Yeah, I think that that's basically the right way to say it. And I think, like many things, we have the Yankees and Cubs to blame for this. if you remember the curse-breaking Cubs year, they traded Aroldis Chapman for Gleyber Torres, or rather, the Cubs traded Gleyber Torres for Aroldis Chapman. And I think everyone was like, wow, that guy is a highly regarded prospect. They got him for a rental season of a reliever. Never mind that at that point, I think he was probably considered the best reliever in baseball. And he had, you know, 6 years of track record or whatever it was, 4 years of track record of being unhittable. People said, oh, so you can get great prospects for relievers. The market has just not really shown that for non-established guys in recent years. And that doesn't stop like fans and also me from dreaming like, hey, this guy is doing awesome this year. We should like, and our team is no good. Like, let's flip him and someone will give us a prospect because he'd be their best reliever. I mean, that sounds nice in practice, but yeah, as when you look into the data, it doesn't really work that way. These guys who come out of nowhere to have good half seasons. Look, I'm not saying they're bad. Having a good half season is a great indication that you're good, but they're much more above average than elite. And I think that the market kind of properly reflects that. You can't like basically just peel off 20 great innings and then have everyone think that you're now Josh Hader. Although I guess he's been kind of bad this year. So perhaps that's kind of part of the problem.
Yeah, it is. Reliever performance is volatile. By the way, Josh Hader is the only pitcher in baseball with more than 25 saves over the last 4 years who has a higher save conversion percentage than Jordan Romano, who we get texts in the text line about regularly of like, should the Jays move off of Romano as the closer? Are you worried about Romano? Relief pitcher stuff is really, really volatile. So you did a chat the other day and you got asked about the Jays potentially being sellers. And you said, no, not yet. But like, I think they're a slow month away from being really interesting sellers. Now, there are some bigger names that we could talk about as well. But with respect to Jimmy Garcia, a reliever who has arguably the best numbers in baseball right now. We're talking 99th percentile expected ERA. He's number one in terms of expected results on his fastball among all pitchers in baseball. 99th percentile chase rate. And this is a guy who he had an ERA of 409 last year, but he had a 310 the year before that. He has some seasons in the threes for ERA as well. Is that a guy that you think would, if things go poorly for the Jays the next couple weeks, be near the top of the relief pitcher market?
I do. I think that like you mentioned, he had a, you know, kind of a, actually, honestly, didn't have that bad of a year last year. 4.09 ERA is better than it sounds. In 2023, that was a, not like a little bit more offensive of a year overall, but he's actually had, looking at it here, like four straight years of pretty good, like underlying run prevention data. Even 2021, he was, you know, not incredible, but he was like completely playable. He's not one of these guys who's come up out of nowhere. Over the last 4 years, so from 2021 to now, ignoring his like outrageous, very short season 2020, he has a 3.50 ERA, a 3.50 FIP, a 3.59 xFIP. So basically, like, all of his numbers say this is who he is, and who he is pretty good. I mean, 3.50 ERA in a reliever, it doesn't sound that exciting, but no one has three guys like that. Like, pretty much everyone would like a pitcher like that. And I think to the point of this, pop-up relievers are not worth as much as you think. He's not really that.
Right.
He has a long track record. I'm surprised to say this because this is a classic case of until you dig into the numbers, you don't think it. Because I can picture him blowing up, you know. His meltdowns to me somehow seem memorable. And when he's not going right, it's like a lot of walks and just ugly. But the thing is, he doesn't actually walk that many guys overall. He's like actually got pretty good command. I can just picture the fail cases more.
And I think that's
data would tell you he's good.
Yeah, I think that's what a lot of us as baseball fans do with relief pitchers, right? Like even like again the Jordan Romano example, like he's blown fewer saves than basically anyone with a ton of saves over the last couple years, but you remember that a lot more than you remember him coming in to face 7-8-9 in the order with a 2-run lead, right? Like you just it's how those things stick out to you. So in this chat, you were getting asked though about the bigger kind of things, the bigger sales the Blue Jays could make. And this is a little awkward to talk about when they've won 4 or 5 and we're coming off like the most feel good 2 games of the season for them, but we don't have you on every day. So, you know, what would interest you about the Blue Jays if let's say they come out of this Detroit, Chicago, Pittsburgh stretch and things haven't gone that well. And then, you know, they're up against Baltimore right out of that stretch and things don't go well there. If we're still talking about a sub 500 Jays team in a couple weeks, why do they get so interesting to you on the trade side?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, like you said, I'll first say this is a pretty good problem to have for the Jays because if they play well for the next month, then that's probably because all these guys are great and they just keep them and you know, they're right in the mix. We have them like as about 1-4 to make the playoffs, but you get hot for a week and that changes pretty quickly. The reason I think they're so interesting is because they, like, one thing that you often think about these selling teams is it's like the reason that they're selling is because they're bad. And the reason that they're bad is because the guys who they want to trade have performed worse than expected. And so they're not as interesting as you think. That's not really the case here. Just kind of by fluke of the way that the Jays roster is set up, a lot of their issues have been with guys who they're not actually trading. Like maybe in fantasy land, you're talking about trading Bo Bichette, but that's not happening. Like that's just not how this works. They're not trading Vlad. Trades like that are just pretty unlikely to happen. The guys who are more likely to get moved are kind of older pitchers, people on expiring deals. And those are actually some of the better performers on the team. Like Yusei Kikuchi has been incredible this year. And I actually think he'd be the first call the Blue Jays get along with Danny Jansen. And Kikuchi in particular, this is another thing where if you're not paying close enough attention, like if you're a fan of a team trading for Kikuchi, let's say, not a Jays fan, you'd be like, that guy, no, he's bad. But he's not. And he wasn't bad last year either. And really the only truly awful year he's had recently is, his first year with the Jays where he was bad. But this is another case of, look, this isn't just a month and a half, 2 months of good performance here. Like if you model how good his pitches are, very good.
Yes.
You know, great fastball, which has always been the case. It doesn't jump off the page with velocity, but he throws hard and it has just incredible shape. He's commanding the ball pretty well, but he was commanding the ball pretty well last year and had pretty good results to show for it, to be honest. Like we thought he was meaningfully above average last year and he's been a lot better this year. And all of our predictive models, all of our descriptive models of what he's done say, hey, this guy's great. You know, this is not a case of a pop-up starter. But he's also performing. So it's not one of these like, well, I think Kevin Kiermaier is in a similar boat where he's better, but he's performed worse this year. Kikuchi is just like, he's a true rental. He's playing great right now. He's projected pretty well. I think that he's the kind of name who could actually fetch like a prospect that you've heard of, that I've heard of, that makes you pretty excited about it, particularly if you package in some of the other like interesting but not quite as interesting names. One that I'm actually pretty excited about, I was doing a little research before this call. So Danny Jansen, free agent after this year, and obviously just killing it. Honestly, he's just been killing it for years. he's kind of, you know, unheralded, and he's not always the flavor of the week, but he's just really exciting. And he's great again this year. I don't think he's this good, obviously. I don't think anyone thinks he's this good.
Yeah, the only guys this good are like Juan Soto and Shohei Ohtani, so it's fair to say.
Yeah, exactly. But there's actually a clear case of need and ability here that lines up. Not a lot of contending teams need catchers this year, but the Cubs really do. The Cubs' catching situation is a disaster. So they have Miguel Amaya, who's an interesting prospect, but he's not playing well. He's like, they would really prefer not to play him. The problem is that their backup is Yan Gomes, who has just been offensively a black hole. So they're just in this situation where, hey, they're like a really good team. They desperately need catching, and they really don't want to block the guy that they think is the catcher of the future in Amaya past this year. So Jansen's a pretty good fit there. They also happen to have one of the best farm systems in baseball. So, you know, that's a pretty good fit there. And in addition, they could use some pitching. Like, things actually line up pretty well here, because the Blue Jays past Jansen, I think their most attractive trade pieces are all pitchers. And if you look at what the Cubs are doing, like, a lot of it is coming from the fact that they're hitting pretty well. Their bullpen is like kind of hot. It's a hodgepodge, really. They could use one or two more starters. A lot of their guys who they were counting on this year have not been as good as expected. Kyle Hendricks seems like he's kind of just done, unfortunately, which is, yeah, sad, but inevitable. It's a situation where this team is good, the Cubs. They have a need for more players, and they have a lot of prospects to the point where they're probably in the market to move a decent number of good prospects just to avoid like the classic situation of, we have three good shortstop prospects, and so two of them won't get to play, and one of those will lose a lot of value. So I actually think this is like, it's weird to say the Jays are in the driver's seat because, like, you know, they're not playing that well this year, but a lot of the guys who they would look to trade are playing great. It's win-win in that if they're playing well and don't need to trade, cool. But yeah, I think that's actually a place where I haven't heard any rumors about this at all yet. This is kind of a no sources reporting thing, but those two teams make a lot of sense to me to link up. If Toronto says, all right, we need to reset. I don't think this is a like big tear down, completely redo everything. Like I mentioned Gausman, I don't think they're going to trade him with as much as left on his deal as there is. I think someone would really need to bowl them over with an offer, but you know, if we get to July and they're not in the playoff race, they should be trading Garcia and Kikuchi and Jansen. And I think there'll be a real market for all three of those guys.
And with the Cubs example, the Cubs top eight prospects per Fangraphs are all in AA or higher. So if the Jays are looking to do a quick retool, those are guys close to the majors. Ben Clemens of Fangraphs, thanks so much for taking the time out this morning, buddy.
Absolutely, Blake. Thanks for having me on.
Ben Clemens of Fangraphs. You can check out all his great work over there. Five things that he liked and didn't like every Friday. And every July, around mid-July, he does a trade value column, the top trade value guys in baseball. So we'll definitely bring him on more as trade season gets closer and as we have a more crystallized look at where the Blue Jays sit. Again, a little awkward to talk to trade stuff when the Jays have won 4-5, but they're still a couple games under 500. They're still trying to pull themselves back up to where we could talk about them as buyers, and they're trying to do that against a weak stretch of schedule here. We're going to take a break. Second hour, we got Dan Schulman joining us. Tyler Toffoli, NHL player who's close friends with Justin Turner, will come on with us as well. We'll also go through a bunch of your texts. So send us in your text, 590-590. You buying this little turnaround from the Blue Jays. You like the jacket back. Jays Talk Plus continues on Sportsnet.
big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy with you for another hour here. Jays back in action tonight, 6:40 at Comerica in Detroit. It's Alec Manoah against Matt Manning. A little programming note, 1:10 start tomorrow. Sunday's game is 11:35 a.m. because of MLB's new package with Roku, but no change for you, the Toronto or Canada-based Toronto Blue Jays fan. You will still have the Sportsnet broadcast. You will still have our next guest on the call. It's Dan Shulman of Sportsnet. Dan, good morning. Thanks for doing this. How we doing, man? Let's fingers crossed for a more normal day today.
We are, and I guess most people probably know or experienced what happened last night. And of course, it's going to happen like 2 minutes before first pitch, right, where there's a power outage. But let me say this, because I spent a little bit too much time on Twitter, and for people who are like, some people are blaming the wrong forces here. Like, this was the story here is there was some sort of underground explosion, like a manhole cover flew up into the air and in the general vicinity of the ballpark, and that impact that severed some power lines that feed the truck compound at the ballpark. The truck compound, for people who don't know, is where the television trucks are, and that's how the signal gets back to Toronto and all and everywhere. So it knocked us off the air. It knocked the Tigers off the air. It has nothing to do with the Blue Jays or Rogers or Sportsnet or Bally Sports, or for that matter. So it was a widespread thing. And then I don't know what you were doing in the moment, Blake, if you were watching, listening, or okay. And but I think we just tried to have fun with it. Like, what could you do, right? You know. Yeah. So I want to thank our crew, the Tigers crew and the Blue Jays crew, the people at the ballpark and back in Toronto with Sportsnet. I mean, everybody did an incredible job just being able to get whatever sort of broadcast was on the air last night in the middle innings. And then I guess by the seventh, we were kind of up and running again. But it was an experience as we drank a couple of beers after the game. We all laughed about it then. It wasn't so funny in the moment, but we did what we could, and hopefully people had some fun with it.
Yeah, it seemed like everyone, at first it's like, what the heck's going on? And then once it is what it is, most of what I saw, other than the bad actors who are never having fun with anything, was people having fun with it and making the most of it. Did you talk to any of the guys post game? I'd imagine it's funny that, like, IKF hits a home run and a triple, and the Jays never hit triples. And there's no video, really, or it's not synced up or whatever. Were the guys having some fun with it after the game as well, once they found out exactly what was going on?
I didn't see players after the game, so I'm afraid I can't help you there. I don't know even if they know. You know, players are obviously very locked in on what they are doing. And it was funny because it was kind of piece by piece where you realized, oh, we don't have any video. Oh, okay. Oh, I'll go to MLB Research, which is a site you know very well. Oh, StatCast isn't working too. And it was funny. In the press box to our right where the print media are, they appeared to have power. And the Tigers radio booth is just to our left. They appeared to have power. But anything that was running through the TV compound didn't have power. I don't know why Research and StatCast weren't working, but like I couldn't even, and I think I joked about it on the air, I couldn't even tell you exit velocity or launch angle or distance on the home run by Kiner Falefa. It didn't exist. And I don't know if they can piece that stuff together later, like our archaeologist going to come in now and try to figure out what happened last night. But it was surreal and bizarre. I've had, obviously having done this for a zillion years, I've been involved in broadcasts that have had technical issues before, but I don't think everyone quite like this. This was different. And again, hopefully people took it in the only spirit that they should have taken it in, which was, hey, we're all in this together, guys. So let's see what we can do here.
Yeah. As it was explained to me, we won't get that stuff back. Like, they could probably piece together kind of Falefa's home run or whatever. But like, if Kevin Gausman wants to know his velocity readings or the break on his pitches, that's done, because those cameras just weren't working and logging those things. So it's kind of a mystery game in retrospect. It's also, I don't know. I found it, I don't know if it was too stressful in the moment for you, but I found it interesting just from the perspective of how we tell stories as media, right? It is, you know, okay, well, you don't have that thing to lean on. You know, Isaiah Kiner-Falefa gets a home run and a triple, and I'm looking up, when was the last time a Blue Jay had a cycle? Has Isaiah Kiner-Falefa ever done that? You guys, maybe it's me texting you that information since you guys don't have the internet there. Did you take a minute to reflect at all on, you know, that part of our jobs? And I don't even mean like data in terms of like the analytics and like, oh, the expected stats of this, but just like the way that our jobs have been made easier and the way we can tell, you know, use that information to tell stories. And you guys had to yesterday kind of turn that off and tell the story a different way.
Right. Sure. And there were some things we did have, some things we didn't.
Yeah.
So I still did have the internet in our booth.
Okay.
And this was in a rare moment of intellectual clarity. What I did, because we didn't have Wi-Fi, what I did was disable the Wi-Fi on my phone and tethered my laptop to my phone, if that's the right way to say it. I'm sure you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And so I was just going off 5G. So it wasn't super fast. It was a little bit slower. I'm sure a lot of other people were doing the same thing. But I still had my computer. Now, there were certain things, even having the internet, I couldn't find, because they were like the StatCast stuff that we were talking about. But if I wanted to go on Baseball Reference as Alex Fiedo came into the game, I could do that. So that kind of stuff was still, some of the stuff was still available to me. The other thing that maybe it's hard for people to understand, but I'll try to explain it, is it's really hard to broadcast a game when I don't know what you are seeing at home. And our monitors were down. So, you know, eventually, I guess a camera from the scoreboard at Comerica came up. But I didn't know until this morning, I don't think. It was just locked off on the plate.
Mm-hmm.
Like if the ball was hit to third, it wasn't swiveling to third. And so, you know, you were just getting pitcher, catcher, that kind of stuff. The reason I know that is I saw a clip on Twitter this morning, the double play, the backhanded scoop by David Schneider, which was a terrific play, except nobody in the world will ever see it. But it was a terrific play. But I saw the clip, and it just kind of lingers on Gausman on the mound, and then he points out to Schneider, but you don't see the play that's made. So it's really nice when I know what you're seeing at home, and then I can, you know, talk along with it and try to make sure it's all in sync and that sort of stuff. So, but yeah, it was kind of back to basics. It was a little bit of a radio call. And then, to be honest with you, because I knew you had some sort of video at home, and you can probably tell this because you watch and listen to a lot of games, you know, Siddle and I kind of strayed off the play-by-play sometimes, right? And we just got a little bit more conversational, et cetera. And again, there's no handbook for this that tells you how to do this. You just kind of feel your way through it. But yeah, it was a bit challenging, a bit fun, a bit of a throwback. And again, we were all laughing about it in the hotel bar after the game, but nobody ever wants to have to do it again.
that makes sense. I thought you guys did a great job with it. And obviously the tech crews and everyone trying to get together what we could. Ben Shulman and Chris LaRue on the radio side, I tuned into them for a little bit at the start because we had a radio call before we had the video feedback up and stuff. So great job from everyone all around, kind of trying to make chicken salad out of what they were handed there, if you know the saying. So, Dan, yes. Outside of all the chaos, also a pretty fun and exciting game. The Blue Jays win 9-1. The offense is there again for the third time in the last four games. And I guess, maybe an oversimplification given how many guys contributed the last 2 days. But, I mean, this offense certainly feels a lot better when Bo and Vlad are hitting like they have the last couple weeks. Is that too big an oversimplification?
No, I don't think so. It starts with those two guys. There's no question. It starts with Guerrero and Bichette. And, you know, Jansen being hot is awesome. And Schneider having big moments is great. Kiner-Falefa, Barsho hitting for power. All of those things are great. But, you know, all of those other things, as great as they are, to me, don't amount to enough unless Guerrero and Bichette are swinging the bats. And listen, they're both absolutely on a tear right now in certain respects. And can we expect this to continue? Who knows? It'll probably level off a bit. But if it levels off to their career norms, that is still pretty good. And you know, I think we do have to say, they've won four or five. They've scored 32 runs in those five. But three of those games were against the White Sox. Last night, most of the damage, almost all the damage, came against the Tigers' bullpen, and it wasn't their top guys who were in the game. So, you know, not to pump the brakes too much, but I think you need to see it again and again and again a few times before you say, okay, they're on their way to digging themselves out of this. Now, I thought Jack Flaherty would be extremely tough on them last night, and he was. He made a mistake to Varsho, and he paid the price, and that turned out to be probably the biggest hit of the game. But, you know, Matt Manning certainly has ability, and let's see what he does. And the next couple of days, it could be Reese Olson, it could be Casey Mize, it could be Kenta Maeda. It's going to be two of those three. All three of those guys have the, you know, can go out and stick it to you on any given night. They're all pretty good. So I'm curious what they do the rest of this series against the Tigers. Then they get the White Sox again. And I know you know this, but for people who don't know, they're not seeing Tarek Skubal this series. Yeah. They're not seeing Garrett Crochet when they revisit the White Sox. And they're not seeing Jared Jones and Paul Skeens when they play the Tigers. I haven't crunched the numbers, but this is lottery ticket kind of luck that they are missing these guys in these next three series. That's great, but you got to take advantage by beating up on the guys you are facing. And in my opinion, they still have to win a lot more than they lose over the next 10 days or so just to, you know, kind of get back to the 500 mark, get their heads above water, and then see where they are.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously that's great for the Jays from a record standpoint. I'm still kind of hoping something changes in the plan with Skeens and or Jared Jones so we can get a look at them. But yeah, this is, look, and we talked about this heading into this 13-game series, this 13-game set against lesser opponents here. You know, no one, they could go 13-0 over those games, and there would be some people who are still, you know, okay, well, you beat the teams you're supposed to beat. And that would be a little extreme for 13-0, but say they go 9-4 over this 13-game stretch that gets them back to 500. I don't think anybody's doing backflips about it. It's just what you need to do to get back to where we can kind of reset and start talking about what this team needs to do moving forward. So, yeah, it is Matt Manning tonight. As BNS pointed out to us earlier in the show, last time he faced the Jays was that collective no-hitter that Detroit threw against them in July last year. Were you on that one, Dan?
Yes, I was. Yeah. And he's got that kind of stuff. He's got that kind of arm. And again, the Blue Jays weren't a great offensive team last year. And he's had his ups and downs. Earlier last year, he actually pitched well against them. And I think got knocked out of the game on his last pitch of the game. Alejandro Kirk hit him in the foot. Or was that 2 years ago? Maybe that was 2 years ago. I think Kirk, with a comeback, or broke his foot. And he's had all kinds of injury trouble, like Casey Mize, like Tarek Skubal, like all of their guys have had trouble staying healthy. So, but he's got ability, and he's got a legit 95-mile-an-hour fastball, and he's got a splitter for lefties, and he's got good breaking balls for righties. Like, he's a good pitcher, and this is going to be a challenge again for them tonight.
Okay, so we also have an 11:35 a.m. game on Sunday, and we don't know who's starting on the Detroit side for that yet. But not to make the whole segment about broadcast weirdness. Have you called a baseball game that early? I'm sure you've done a college basketball one around that time of day, but have you done a baseball game that early?
I don't believe I have, because I don't believe I've ever done a Blue Jay game at Boston on Patriots Day, which is an 11:05 start. Oh, I'm sorry, we did. So this Roku package used to be, was Peacock, like last year or 2 years ago. And there was, the Blue Jays were on it. I think it was the Tigers, actually, in Toronto. So we had a home game, a Sunday home game, that we called at 11:35. I've done a bunch of basketball games early because, you know, prepare the violin music here. I get to do the Maui Invitational every year. Uh-huh. And those games are synced up to be at a decent, you know, you're playing four games a day. You got to start them pretty early out there to get them into a decent television window back in the Eastern time zone. So I've done a bunch of 9 a.m. basketball games, but I think this will be just my second morning baseball game. There's a phrase in baseball, show and go, which means basically everybody, players and perhaps broadcasters, are told just get there when you need to get there in order to do your job. And I have a feeling Sunday morning might be a show and go kind of day.
Yeah, for anyone who doesn't know, you know, the Jays play at 3 o'clock on Saturdays, and usually, you know, the clubhouse opens at 11, and most guys are there already starting their work, but maybe some filter in a little after that. Pitchers operate differently than hitters. And then a 1 o'clock game on Sunday, it's not, you know, you're maybe not there 4 hours early, but guys are there a significant chunk before the game still. I don't imagine anyone showing up at 7:30 Sunday morning to get their early work in. I think Sundays are generally a no batting practice on the field day anyway. Have you talked to anyone yet about what that adjustment might be like from, I mean, who's starting on Sunday? It's Kikuchi on Sunday. So we already know the fake thing about him getting 14 or 15 hours of sleep a night. Now he's got the early start as well. Have you talked to any of the players about the unusual start time?
It's on my list today to do. Yeah, if Kikuchi's really going to get that much sleep, he'll have to go to bed at like 5 in the afternoon on Saturday in order to get a good night's sleep. So we'll see. I think guys in the minors tend to have a little bit more of this weirdness every now and again. You get a rain out, and then on the next day they'll play 2 7-inning games, and you might start one early. So I don't think it'll be that strange for them. And the fact that Saturday is a day game helps. Like if Saturday were a 7 p.m. game and then Sunday is 11:35, I think there'd be some grumbling. Also, in Detroit, the hotel the team stays at is like 5 blocks from the ballpark. So for them, it's a 3-minute bus ride. That helps. It's not going to Yankee Stadium or going, down to up to Wrigley Field from downtown Chicago or something like that. So I think everybody will do what they have to do to be as ready as they need to be. But Kikuchi is an interesting one to talk to, because the starting pitchers obviously tend to have more of a routine than your typical everyday player, I would think, because it's just a once every 5 or 6 days kind of thing. So I'll pick his brain today about what he's going to do, how early he's going to get there. But I am curious, like, will the guys go out and take ground balls? They take, they're Carlos Fabelis and Gil Kim, and the guys are out there with the infielders every day. There won't be BP, but will they be doing anything at all, or will they literally wander out on the field for the national anthems? I'm not sure, but I'll find out for you today.
That'd be fun to hear about. And yeah, the Bisons played, the AAA Buffalo Bisons played at 11 a.m. yesterday. So some of those guys, maybe it's an Ernie Clement day, like someone who's more recently familiar with that. Okay, so that's Sunday. Tonight, Alek Manoah is starting. We saw him in one of his comebacks last year have a pretty good start in, I believe it was his first start back up after being optioned initially against the Tigers. He's coming off of two pretty encouraging starts here. What are you looking for from Alek Manoah tonight? This is the Detroit team. They'll play a couple of lefties, so you do have that kind of platoon thing there, but they have not hit right-handed pitching well at all, especially for power this year. What's kind of front of mind for you in this fourth start for Alek Manoah?
So I remember last year's start, and you're right, it was his first start back after his first demotion. He didn't come back after the second demotion. And it was a bad Tigers offensive team, and it was a good spot for him. And I remember Joe and I on the air saying things like encouraging and good step forward. And we both walked out of there saying he was better, but how much of this was the Tigers? We thought he hung a few sliders over the middle of the plate. And had he been playing the Astros or the Yankees, or it might have been a different story. So I thought he did pretty well in that start. I think it's at a different level his last two starts this year. Again, not to, go too far too fast, but looking more like 2022 Alek Manoah than the, kind of the good version of last year. And he did have a few good starts. So his velocity clearly is back, and he's never been a huge velocity guy, but everybody's better at 95 than you are at 93, all other things being equal. But mostly he's been in the strike zone. He only walked one last time, and I know he hit two. He grazed a couple of guys with two-seam fastballs, right-handed batters. But generally his command has been very good. When his velocity is good and his command is good, there is no reason in the world he can't be a good starting pitcher in the major league. So I think they've both been very good efforts. And again, I don't want to proclaim him as this, that, or the other thing just yet. Let's let him go start to start and just keep building on the foundation and making sure he's in a good place. I talked to him a couple of days ago. He said his confidence is good, but he made it sound like it didn't waver that much when things weren't going well. He's learned some hard lessons, I would imagine, and those are, it's perfectly good for him to keep those to himself, but I'm sure he's learned some very hard lessons in the last year and a half, and, maybe he comes out of this stronger and better for it. So, as you say, it's not a good offensive team. They don't hit righties very well. The one thing he can't do is just don't give them free bases. Make them hit their way on, and if he forces them to hit their way on, I think he'll have a good night.
And hey, to hear Kevin Gausman tell it after the game, maybe they need to unplug the velo readers, the velocity readers, before this game. Because Gausman thought not having access to that stuff was maybe gave him a little bit of an edge against the Tigers when we don't know, but he didn't feel like he had his best stuff. Alek Manoah, a guy who, as long as he feels good, probably doesn't need to be looking at the radar gun there. Dan, are either of these last three games Joe Siddle day down at the ballpark? This is Joe Siddle country.
Every day is Joe Siddle day here at the ballpark. He So a couple of things there. I guess for every player who played for the Tigers, there's a brick somewhere like outside the ballpark in the kind of the main walking in area with the name of the Tiger player. But I don't think Joe's ever found his brick. So I think that's one of his things is to find his brick. And he did say that tomorrow a whole bunch of friends from Windsor are coming over. They're all going to go to the game together, and then they'll all go out to dinner. So we're literally like 4 miles from his house here at Tiger Stadium and or Tiger Stadium, way to go, Dan, at Comerica Park. And it's fun for him. It's a lot of fun for him. It's memories for him as a player. And he also gets a chance to share in his work world with his family and friends a little bit. So it's really fun. I love coming here. The people are great here. I mean, yes, they have the odd power outage. We've got to work on that. But the people are great. I think the ballpark is underrated. I think this, if I were listing in terms of like, I really love that ballpark, to me, this is easily inside the top 10. Easily. Like, and, you know, maybe up like 4, 5, 6, somewhere like that. I think it's a really nice park. I love the Tigers home white uniforms. I kind of dig the whole scene here. And for Joe, I know it's a lot of fun. He's always happy when he gets a chance to work on a series here so close to home.
Well, if anyone is listening and finds the Joe Siddle brick, don't find the Joe Siddle home 4 kilometers from the ballpark.
But if you
find the Joe Siddle brick, tweet at Dan and Joe so they can find it as well. Dan, thanks for taking the time out this morning. Great job working through it yesterday. And appreciate you, man. Have a great weekend.
All right, Blake. Thanks. You too. Talk to you again.
Dan Shulman, voice of the Toronto Blue Jays, whether through TV or cell phone. Fun one yesterday that, again, this isn't just because we're at Sportsnet here. I thought they did a terrific job having some fun with it and making the most out of having no power and very, very limited power once it came back down at Comerica Park there. Dan providing us the detail there that there was some sort of underground explosion that took out the power for all the trucks there, and it happened right before the game began. So a tough one there. No power outage for the Blue Jays. Ha, ha, ha. 9 runs again in this one. So look, they're doing what they're supposed to do right now. They are taking care of the lesser teams on the schedule. We'll see if they can continue to do that tonight, do that against a guy like Matt Manning, who they struggled against last year. They've also had some good results against in prior years, and he's having a down year right now compared to when they saw him for that shared no-hitter last year. So we'll see how that goes. You can text us the 590-590. What are you looking forward to in this series? What are you looking for from Alek Manoah tonight? Are you buying the 27 runs over the last 4 games? Things like that. We're going to take a break. We'll talk to Tyler Toffoli, NHL player and big baseball fan, after the break, and we'll get to a bunch of your texts at 590-590. We'll tee up Alek Manoah against Matt Manning tonight as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. That's the goal song of Tyler Toffoli, Winnipeg Jets forward, who will join us in a little bit here to talk about his friendship with Justin Turner and his Blue Jays and baseball fandom. Maybe he'll be checking out Alek Manoah against Matt Manning tonight down at Comerica. It's a 6:40 start. Programming note, as I mentioned a little earlier when we were speaking to Dan Shulman, 1:10 game on Saturday, 11:35 a.m. game on Sunday. No change to our coverage. It's still a Sportsnet game here in Canada. You've still got Dan and Joe and Hazel on the broadcast for that one. Still got Blue Jays Central beforehand and all that. It's just an 11:35 start. So if you had one of those schedules printed out or the magnet ones from the start of the season, it will say the wrong time. It is an 11:35 game. I'll be on Blue Jays Central tomorrow with Danielle Michaud and Caleb Joseph. If you would like to hear more of me, if 2 hours a day now is still somehow not enough. Jays win yesterday, a chance to make sure they get at least a series split tonight as they take on Matt Manning. We talked earlier in the show, last time Blue Jays saw Matt Manning, he went 6 2/3 against them as part of a combined no-hitter. We'll set that matchup more a little bit and take a look at what Matt Manning throws, how the Jays match up, things like that. Justin Turner, probably in the lineup as the designated hitter tonight. He came in as a pinch hitter last night, came up with a big hit. We're joined now by one of his best friends, Winnipeg Jets forward Tyler Toffoli. Tyler, what's up, man? Thank you for doing this.
How are we doing?
Good, man. Good. So you and Justin Turner, I mean, Justin Turner's talked about this a little bit. I know you've talked about it before. Can you give me a little insight into, you know, how you guys became so close and where you're, I'm what I assume is Blue Jays fandom since you grew up in Scarborough has now overlapped with your Justin Turner fandom.
Yeah, well, obviously we go back to both playing in LA, and I think I went to one of the games. I think we won the cup, and we brought the cup to Dodger Stadium, and went there and ended up meeting my wife, and obviously his wife and my wife now are have been best friends, and he's a big hockey fan, and like you said, I grew up watching the Jays, and it kind of just happened sort of naturally, and it was nice to catch up and be in Toronto a couple weeks ago too.
Yeah, you got to come down and check out that game. So when you were growing up, obviously it's hockey first. Did you play baseball? Were you down at a lot of Jays games growing up in the GTA?
Yeah, I played a little bit growing up, and we used to go take the train in and go to the baseball games. I think it was on Tuesdays or whatever it was, and sit in the nosebleeds. I think tickets were back then $2 a ticket, and I'd go with my old man, and we'd have a great time.
That's awesome. Me too. Yeah. Drive in from Cambridge for me, not the train in from Scarborough. But yeah, miss the $2 days. Tyler, you also, yeah. I know when you guys, you know, this is a cool thing about being a pro athlete, I imagine. You get to go to Dodger Stadium, you bring the cup. You get to take some hacks as well. You get to get in there and swing. How is your baseball game these days? Can you put a charge into one or what?
Oh, well, I was fortunate. My wife used to work for the Dodgers, so she would host Kings Night. And so a bunch of the Kings players would go in and they let us hit BP and stuff. So I hit maybe four or five separate times. And the last time I swung a bat, I hit a home run at Dodger Stadium. So I think I'm retired from now.
Man, what a feeling that must have been. How tempted were you to, like, trot around the bases?
Not really, because all the baseball guys started walking out, and I was already pumped and a little embarrassed from them chirping from the first couple swings I took before that.
Well, I'm impressed anyway, man. That's got to be a really cool feeling to hit one out at Dodger Stadium. So I'd imagine your friendship with Justin, there is some chirping and stuff like that. But you've been pretty involved with some of the charitable initiatives that he does, the Justin Turner Foundation. Can you tell me a little bit about, you know, what Justin does on that side, why you've been so eager to team up with him on it?
Well, I think just the hard work that him and his wife put in, and the dedication that they put in, honestly, daily, it's impressive. So the NHL used to do a thing for every hat trick you would get, you get some money to donate, and I would always, you know, donate to them. And every time they do their golf tournament, I think I've only been able to do it once or twice, but normally it's usually around the All-Star break, but the past couple of years, it's been like a day or two off when I have to get back to work. But when I was in LA, I used to be able to go and make it. So just the hard work that they put in, and I see it, and just to support them and do everything that I can, it's you know, it's just great.
Yeah, that is great. And you know, the hat trick, hey, it's great that you guys get to donate for a hat trick. Maybe the NHL can lower the bar a little bit too. The hat tricks aren't all that common. I know you've had them and had them in the outdoor games as well. You've played in a couple of those outdoor games now. I know you had another one this year in that stadium series. Do you have a favorite of the ones you've played, or like a baseball stadium you'd love to play at if it worked out in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I played in three or four, I think, now, but the obviously the hat-trick one is pretty memorable for me, especially because I literally got traded the next day or 2 days later, so I'll never forget that one. But I think the one last year at MetLife was also really cool. It was packed, it was cold, it had everything that you wanted in an outdoor game, and just had a lot of fun with it, and obviously, you know, winning makes it all better too. So
yeah, certainly. Another cool thing you got to do on the hockey side this year as a member of the Winnipeg Jets, that first round playoff game, you got to experience the whiteout as a part of the home team. How was that experience for you, and getting to play for another Canadian team in general?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's all the hype around it, and you never really know what to expect until you finally, you know, experience it in person. And I just remember it's a short walk from the locker room up on the ice, and we're pretty much standing right in front of the doors and basically walking onto the ice, and you could hear the fans going crazy. And once the doors open, you see the whiteout, and it was just, it was one of those where you're excited, you're nervous, but you can do nothing but kind of smile and get excited for it.
It looks like a lot of fun on TV. I won't ask you. I know you've been in the playoffs with four different Canadian teams now. I won't ask you to compare across, but you know, I would be curious to hear that that off air. Another cool thing you got to do. You won a gold medal as the captain of Team Canada at the IIHF Worlds last year. Did you give some consideration to running that back? I know they've got a semifinal game over there in Czechia tomorrow.
No, I didn't hear from him, but I mean, just being in the playoffs and not having a contract for next season, it's one of those things where it'd be kind of tough to even say yes to. Obviously, you want to, you know, play for Canada and experience that as many times as you can. But even in that sense, it would have been a pretty difficult decision, to be honest.
Yeah, and you went, you did it, and came out on top. You got the gold last year, so that's not a bad way to leave it for now. You are a free agent. Obviously, you can only talk about so much, but you know, at this point in your career, you're still similar to your boy Justin Turner. You know, kind of hitting your groove the most here in your early 30s, coming off of a really strong season. Have been traded a lot because these playoff teams want you a part of the mix. What are you looking for, kind of as a free agent this summer?
Yeah, I think some stability goes a long way. Like you said, I've moved around a lot the past couple of years and want to try and lay some roots down and figure something out. You know, maybe get a house and, like I said, just lay some roots down. So we'll see what happens. Obviously, there's still some time before free agency even starts, and haven't really, you know, thought about it a whole too lot lately, to be honest.
Yeah, and you can't say all that much. I'm aware as well.
True.
Yeah. All right. Tyler, you back this way anytime soon to get another Jays game in or what?
I'm not sure. I usually do another trip later on in the summer and stay with my parents and work with my skating coach. So I'm assuming if I'm going to be in town and the Jays are in town, I'll be hitting Justin up and supporting the boys.
Awesome. Glad to hear it, man. Best of luck with the off season ahead. And yeah, thank you for taking the time out. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you. Have a good day.
Tyler Toffoli, Winnipeg Jets forward, free agent forward. Hey, if you're the new Toronto Maple Leafs decision makers and you're listening, this guy's played for a couple Canadian teams, wants some stability. I wonder if that team could use 33, 34 goals as another forward up front. Tyler Toffoli, good friend of Justin Turner, all around good dude. Glad we were able to make time and get him in. We're going to close out the show. It's a Friday. I know we did some call-in stuff yesterday, but we're going to take some of your texts. Feels like a Friday thing. I know Blair and Barker do the call-ins on Fridays, but we're going to do some text line stuff. 590, 590. You can text us in and we'll get to some of these questions. Quickly before we do that, a look at tonight's matchups. Matt Manning against Alek Manoah down at Comerica. So I mentioned Matt Manning, 6 2/3 no hit against the Jays last year, but earlier that year, the Jays have gotten to him. They faced him in the past as well. The Jays have had some roster turnover, so only 51 plate appearances as a team against Manning. They've done a good job making contact. He's only struck out 5 Blue Jays in 51 plate appearances, but they have a .196 batting average. So they just really, there is a big gap here between, you know, the way the Jays have put a bat on a ball against Matt Manning and what has actually happened. I'm sure you've heard that before with Blue Jays things. George Springer and Kevin Kiermaier have both homered off of him. Ernie Clement 2-for-3 against him. So not a ton to take from the you know, the matchup data there, given how down a season Manning's having and how much turnover the Jays have had. One thing that you'll hear about Matt Manning when you're watching the broadcast, and this will sound familiar because it's the pitcher type that has given the Blue Jays some trouble. So that fastball that he leads with, it's only 94, but this is another guy, 6'6", good extension down the mound, and will try to keep that fastball up in the zone. That's the kind of guy we know the Blue Jays have struggled with this year. Now that's been a little bit more from the left side. You know, Garrett Crochet just flambéed them, but that's also a guy from the left side who's throwing 98. But this kind of tall righty with the mid 90s fastball that they release far down the mound, think of a Bailey Ober type. That type of guy has given the Blue Jays some trouble. He will also mix in a pretty heavy usage of the sweeper against righties. He's basically fastball sweeper. He does have a slider that could also just be you know, Statcast is catching some of the sweepers as sliders. You never really know when there's just a small number of them. So basically against righties, he's fastball sweeper. Against lefties, he'll go fastball, sweeper, curveball. And he does have a splitter that he doesn't throw very much. It was one of those things to watch in spring training. He kind of debuted it and was throwing it a little bit more. And we just haven't seen a ton of it. He's only thrown 18 of them this year. The fastball has been hit pretty hard. Opponents have a 330 batting average against it and are slugging over 500. So if you can find your way to the fastball instead of that sweeper that does generate a little bit more weak contact, a little bit more swing and miss, maybe that's the way to go if you're the Blue Jays. Alek Manoah, on the other hand, has faced some of these Tigers in the past. They have 42 plate appearances against them. He's struck out seven. You know, the results are reasonable. Only a 297 slugging against them, so that's kind of encouraging. And none of these Tigers have homered off of them. Of course, this is an Alek Manoah who was a different guy in 2022 than he was in 2023, and that 2023 start was kind of his best one there. You know, Manoah, also a guy, by the way, who is 6'6 and gets terrific extension down the mound. So if you're looking for something that the Tigers might be looking for against him, yeah, if he can kind of, you know, the way he gets down the mound with that two-seamer that has that late life in on righties, obviously an effective one there. His best swing and miss pitch being that slider that he'll throw more to righties than to lefties, but he will sprinkle it in against lefties. And then that changeup that we've seen a little bit more of against lefties. So fascinated to see how Alek Manoah looks in that one. The Jays will start Jose Berríos and Yusei Kikuchi on Saturday and Sunday, respectively. The Tigers are still working through which two of Reese Olson, Casey Mize, and Kenta Maeda will start Saturday and Sunday, and which one will start which day. If you're the Blue Jays, you're probably hoping it's Mize and Maeda. If you're the Tigers, you're probably hoping it's Olson and Maeda. Again, Olson took a comebacker in his last start, threw a bullpen yesterday, but we didn't get an update on how that bullpen went or how he was feeling. Kenta Maeda, before going on the IL with an illness, was not pitching particularly well, but obviously there's a really strong track record there as a guy who can figure it out, who can find his way to pitching. He actually struck over 10 batters per nine out last year. It was one of the highest strikeout rates we've seen from him in his major league career. The ERA, you know, was low fours last year. That's probably the type of guy he is at this point, but still a very effective pitcher there. Let's take some of your texts for the last 10 minutes or so here. Leave your name and location, by the way, so we can shout you out as well. Stephen Whippy, this was from the other day, but I wanted to read it because we ran out of time the other day, said he went to his first Jays game at the new Rogers Center the other day, took his 10-year-old. What an amazing game and experience. New stadium is great for kids and everyone, combined with the pitch clocks speeding up the game. Thanks for sharing that, Steve. Glad you and your niece had a good time there. You know, I've heard a lot from people with families, friends with kids and things like that, that yeah, the stadium experience has improved in that regard. I don't have kids. It's nice that it's good for everyone else. Certainly, you know, I actually sat down kind of the right field foul line not that long ago. So those new seats where they're better angled toward home plate, it's a bit of a weird spot to sit. You're definitely looking at home plate better. You do get like a blind spot in the right field corner, but it's definitely an upgrade on what it was before. You definitely feel a lot more in the action than you did in the past. So that's a nice change there at Rogers Center as well. Brian in Toronto asks, in terms of a leadoff hitter, why not Bichette? So Brian, Chris Black and I actually talked about that earlier this week on the show. You know, when Bo Bichette is going, that makes sense as a leadoff hitter. You like a bat to ball guy there. I'm traditionally more of an on base percentage guy than a batting average guy in that top spot. I want someone who's seeing some pitches and setting up the other guys 2-3-4, getting someone on base. But if you're Bo Bichette and you're an aggressive hitter that has to, hey, you're telling that starter, you better throw your best stuff from the very first pitch of this game, a guy who can jump on one early, maybe for extra bases. I have no problem with when Bo Bichette is hitting like Bo Bichette. He's in that leadoff spot. I think they'll give David Schneider a little bit of runway here. He does have the good approach. He too can put, you know, a charge into a ball for a double, get a guy in scoring position early, things like that. There are a couple options there. None of them perfect options. They don't have a prototypical leadoff hitter from an OBP standpoint or a prototypical leadoff hitter from a slap at a board and get moving on the bases standpoint. So it's kind of just, you know, who looks good the last couple of weeks? Who do they like in that matchup? So for now, David Schneider, wouldn't be surprised if Bo Bichette's in there at some point. Wouldn't be surprised if George Springer finds his way back there down the line. I'm going to need to see, you know, a sustained chunk of George Springer being better before I'm ready for that. But that happened last year. He came out of that spot for a month and then was eventually back into it. Dan in Toronto asks, why did the Jays not push harder to sign Danny Jansen, especially after trading Gabriel Moreno? It's a good question, Dan. Having Danny Jansen as a pending free agent right now is a tough spot. I guess it does, you know, if you have to pull the chute on the season, it's not a terrible thing. You know, you'll get more for a guy with years of control versus a rental. But, you know, this front office loves flexibility and things like that. My guess is that they were just have been apart. And a part of why they would be a part of numbers is probably that Danny Jansen will come to a negotiation, or Danny Jansen's people will come to a negotiation and say, look at this production. He hit 43 home runs over the last 3 years in just half a season each season. He's been one of the very best hitting catchers in all of baseball for the last 3.5, 4 years. And the Jays would probably come back and say, yeah, in half of a season. He hasn't stayed healthy. He hasn't stayed on the field. And the, you know, it completely would make sense if we found out after the fact that Danny Jansen was like, no, I'm going to bet on myself. I'm going to hope I play 100 games this year, put up 20, 25 home runs. And then, you know, we can talk contract after that. Takes two in those scenarios. And, you know, with Jansen having had some issues staying on the field, I would imagine the two sides were probably a little bit apart in terms of what that injury risk costs you in a dollar amount. Shane in Oshawa asks, if Vladdy continues this hot stretch, do you think the Jays have more pressure to lock him in long-term, or do they pivot and you see him as a sell-high trade piece? I don't really think it's either, honestly. Like, the trade option, things would have to go very, very bad at the team level to where they don't even think, they lose the confidence that they can turn it around and compete again in 2025. You know, who knows? Maybe they get there. Maybe there's stuff behind the scenes that I don't know about. My read on it is that if they sell this year, it would be with an eye toward retooling for next year and being competitive again next season. And as I always remind in these parts, you know, there's also $400 million in stadium renovations, new suites and stuff like that. I don't know that this front office would have an appetite for like a full teardown if there weren't like a lot of really compelling near-term prospects coming back in a deal like that. As far as locking him in, similar to what I just said with Danny Jansen, I think the sides would probably, you know, we've heard that they're just not doing a lot of talking in season anyway. But if you're Vladimir Guerrero Jr., you're negotiating as if you're the guy who was second in MVP voting and the guy who's hit, you know, a 950 OPS and hit almost 400 over the last month. If you're the Blue Jays, you probably have to look at the totality of the last couple of years and be like, well, we don't know if you're a 150 or a 125 OPS guy. Excuse me one second. Sorry, had to sneeze. Yeah, there's probably a gap there in terms of the player wants to negotiate closer to their ceiling. And, you know, this is something they will absolutely have to revisit in the offseason. You have to have those conversations with Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and Bo Bichette this offseason, so you know if 2025 is, you know, is that the last year of your window? Are you pivoting if you get off to the same start that you got off to this year and things like that? I'd be surprised if 1 month of Vlad hitting a little better and certainly hitting better, but mostly from the contact and on base side, if that changed much about either side's willingness to get an extension done in season. Paul in Burlington is not buying this little hot stretch. We've seen enough to know that they can't compete against the big boys. I'm upset when they win because that gives false hope. I don't know about that. I get what you're saying, Paul. It's an extended comment about, you know, maybe this should, the start should nudge them to retool for next year. It's a long season. Weird stuff in baseball has happened before and will happen again. I understand what you're saying in that certainly you don't want them to beat up on the White Sox, Tigers, and Pirates and think that the team is good enough and you don't have to add and you're just going to roll like this through Baltimore and the Yankees and things like that. There is a reality check coming on June 3rd when they come out of this stretch and face the Orioles again. So I understand that component of it. I don't think beating up on bad teams changes the way you're evaluating this team overall, though. I think they're trying to get back to 500 here. They're trying to buy themselves the month of June to see if they can start playing some better baseball against better teams to convince that, you know, front office to keep the group together and maybe add to it. I don't think this is a case where anyone's going to overreact to, hey, they had two good weeks against, you know, teams that are mediocre in the central divisions. I don't think you have to worry about it too much with regard to that. Andrew Muskoka says he's buying Alex stock today. He'll drink the Kool-Aid. If he goes seven innings with under three earned and under two walks, I would say he's back, and I think 6K would be great. What would that parlay pay out? Amit Mon, our producer, plugged in that parlay. It's not exactly that, but if it was plus 525, and if you add a win in there, it gets the plus 850. So if you're very confident in that, you know, I don't do a lot of in-game betting. I don't do a lot of talking about betting on this show, but since you asked Andrew Muskoka, that's where that line is. I think betting aside, that's a reasonable target for Alek Manoah. If he can give you six, even seven innings, if he can keep that to three runs or under, you know, this isn't a awesome Tigers offense. They're a little bit below average. They don't hit righties for power very well. I think that's a totally reasonable bar to set here. You hope. I think bar-wise, I'm at like, okay, if he can give you six innings with three runs or less, you know, I know that's a 450 ERA, but that's a quality start. We've agreed for the, you know, the last 70 years of baseball that that's a reasonable line for a guy to have. And then, yeah, if he can push that to seven, you mentioned the walks there. I think, him not walking guys is probably, if you're scouting the stat line, if you're box score watching and you can't check out the game, that's probably the thing I'm most interested in, because that tells me he's attacking, that tells me he's trusting his stuff. If he goes six innings and there aren't a lot of walks, that tells me the Tigers haven't been able to square up his stuff around the zone. So I think that's a good indicator there. Thomas asks, if you could add any type of player to the Blue Jays, who would it be? My answer to that is Shohei Ohtani or Juan Soto. My actual answer more to Thomas's question is, probably I'm impartial between left field, second base, and third base. I think those are the three positions where you have enough positional versatility with other guys that if a left fielder falls in your lap, you can play David Schneider at second a little bit more and resolve it that way. If it's a second baseman that falls in your lap, you can figure it out with David Schneider playing a little bit more in left field and suck it up there. A third baseman, you know, Isaiah Kiner-Falefa moves to more second base / utility responsibility. But I think those are the three positions clearly where they could upgrade and shift guys around to make up the rest. And yeah, ideally someone who hits for power. Home runs aren't everything, but this lineup's really, really thin on them. And then if that person happened to hit from the left side of the plate, all else equal, I'd take someone who is left-handed over someone who's right-handed. I'm not that picky. I would love anyone who plays one of those positions and can hit a little bit more than what the Jays have right now to be in here by the time July 30th rolls around. We're getting some NBA questions in here as well. I will not answer those, but I will say a reminder that Amit Mon and Esfandiar Barahany do have a Saturday NBA show here on the station. If you do want to talk hoops, you can check that out tomorrow afternoon. Amit Mon, obviously my producer during the week, but that Saturday NBA show is there as well if you need your hoops fix. Devin in Aurora says, who do you think is the most talented prospect in the Jays organization? Love the show. Devin, thank you for that. On talent, you know, there are different ways to define this. I think Arelvis is the easy answer because the power tool is the best single tool in, like, if you were to grade all the Blue Jays prospect by, okay, the hit tool, the fielding tool, the running tool, the power tool, Arelvis's ability to hit for power is the best single tool in the organization. Maybe Spencer Horwitz is on base, but Spencer Horwitz is almost 27. I don't think we talk about him prospect-wise in the same way. Arelvis's power tool is the shiniest tool there. In terms of overall talent, if we're looking at things like athleticism, absolute upside if everything works out right. Their first-round pick last year, Arjun Namala, is nothing but tools. He's got size, he's got bat speed, he's got the ability to play shortstop for now. That might be on a... You know, if you graded all the tools together without looking at the production just yet, he's probably the most toolsy guy they have. And then on the pitching side, there are some interesting names down at the lower levels of the minors. Kendry Rojas, Fernando Perez, probably the more younger guys you're looking at that are, you know, toolsy at this point, learning how to pitch still, but a lot of talent there. I hope that answered your question properly. Eric from Saskatoon asks, who ends up having the best year, Biggio, Kiermaier, or Ernie Clement? They seem pretty close at this point. That's a good question. And all of those guys are probably looking at their playing time right now, wondering if the Jays were to make an addition or call someone up to AAA, would they be losing out on playing time? I will go with Kevin Biggio. That's just Kevin Kiermaier's on the older end. I think they're comfortable moving him to a fourth outfielder role at some point. Biggio has eight spots on the diamond. He could find time. And he hasn't been good lately, but there is a track record of him figuring out at the plate. I like Ernie Clement's hit tool as well. The defense has been a little shakier than expected the last couple weeks. But those guys will find their way to being solid bench contributors. We are out of time. That snuck up on me. Thank you for the text. We'll continue to sprinkle those in throughout the show all summer. So fire us a text anytime at 590-590. Game tonight, 640, Alec Manoa against Matt Manning. Reminder that that game is 11:35 on Sunday, but no change to our broadcast. You'll have it on Sportsnet. Thank you to Ben Nicholson-Smith, Dan Schulman, Ben Clemens, and Tyler Toffoli for joining us, to Amit Mann, Lance Kennedy, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. We will be back to talk to you Monday at 10 a.m. Break down this series. Have a great weekend, everyone.